Hey, Dr. B.
Hey, Lee. What's going on?
I have a problem.
Yeah, what's up?
You know, it seems like no matter how hard I work on my podcast, I can never get as many downloads as the guys over at the Weekly Brew podcast.
You know, like this reminds me a little bit of last time we were talking together and how self-comparison starts to impact the way that you feel in your creative work. So one thing that
we all go through junk, but we don't have to go through it alone. If you struggle with self-comparison or self-doubt or self-forgiveness or anything really, maybe you just need to talk to somebody. Check out Modern Therapy, a psychology practice here in Houston driven by one overarching mission, to cultivate a well-lived existence despite life's inherent challenges. Check out mymoderntherapy.com to make an appointment with Dr. Beatrice Craven or one of her associates, or give them a call at 281-783-9297 and tell them Luke sent you. Again, that's mymoderntherapy.com. From Milieu Media Group, this is The H, a podcast about the people and places that make Houston, Houston. I'm your host, Luke Brauner, and this is Season 2, Episode 1, Big Wheel, with George Foreman IV.
Years to have fallen before the professional fury of George Foreman.
On November 5th, 1994, 45-year-old boxing legend, Olympic gold medalist, and former world heavyweight champion George Foreman did what most sports analysts believe to be impossible. 20 years and 1 week after his first professional loss, which cost him his heavyweight title to Muhammad Ali, arguably the greatest boxer of all time, Foreman reclaimed the title by knocking out 25-year-old Michael Moorer in an exhausting 10-round battle, making him the oldest heavyweight champion in history, a record that stands to this day. I was a young teenager at the time, and that's when I began to recognize the name George Foreman, a name for which he'd eventually sell the rights for nearly $140 million to Salton Incorporated, the housewares company responsible for the famous George Foreman grill. A name which he also gave to each of his five sons.
My name is George Edward Foreman IV. There's 10 kids, 5 boys and 5 girls. All the boys are George, Natalie, Leola, Michi, Frida, and Georgetta. But Frida's middle name is George, so it's Frida George Foreman.
So what was the thought process? Why is everybody George?
Man, you ask a different George, you get a different answer. I think the truth is my dad was just, he was proud to be a father. And proud to have his sons and proud to give his sons his name. We have nicknames. Mine's Big Wheel. My brothers are Monk, Red, Junior, and Joe. But we're all George Foreman.
The nickname Big Wheel was passed down from his great-grandfather, which he'd received more than 60 years earlier in Marshall, Texas.
His name was Will Nelson, but they called him Big Wheel. And he owned a small shop in Marshall, Texas. His dream was to have a farm and help the community, and he was a local big shot. You know, when you're in Marshall, Texas in 1920, it doesn't take much to make you a big shot, probably. So you have a store, got a mule, you know, you probably have a wagon, call them a big shot because they have a nice wagon or something. But when I was born, obviously I was George Foreman IV, but I had to have my own name, so they gave me his.
While his mother, Mary Joan Martelli, wasn't initially a fan of the name Big Wheel, instead calling him Will for most of his life, the name was significant to him. And understandably so.
For a while, it was my only sense of individuality. I wasn't Red. Some of my cousins call me Big Red or Big Monk because they mix up the Georges. They don't know which one they're talking to. I'm not George Jr. I'm not George V. If you just say George, there's too many people around. I got to be something, and Big Wheel was it.
As the middle of three sons, even with my own name all to myself, and a father who, while incredible in his own right, isn't one of the most recognizable figures in American sports history. I love you, Dad. I know on some level what it's like to wrestle with your identity and to long for a sense of individuality. To this day, when my mom addresses me, she lists the names of every male member of our family, including my youngest nephew, and I kid you not, her pet cat that died well over a decade ago, before finally calling me by my actual name. I love you, Mom. Both of my brothers are gifted athletes, as is my dad, so I spent most of my adolescence comparing myself and trying to keep up with them, despite my significant athletic deficiencies. So I can only imagine what it would be like to grow up the son of a real-life sports legend. Well, as it turns out, it was much different than I'd have imagined. Life began for George in Humble, Texas in 1988.
For me, life was really being the son of a preacher and the son of an axeman. My dad did a lot of wood chopping. As a kid, you don't really think about why, but you know, he keeps a sharp axe and puts it out in the truck, cuts down a lot of trees. He does a lot of vehicle pulling, a lot of pulling of Jeeps. This is me at 5 years old, living in Humble, you know, going to Rockets games sometimes. I see a picture of him in the newspaper preaching a wedding at an Astros game. But for the most part, I was just son of a cowboy, axeman, and a preacher. That's what my life was. Now, every once in a while, somebody would say something about him having a boxing match. I was never allowed to go to those. When they were televised in like the 90s, usually the main event was on at about 10:30, so I didn't really see the fights either. I was the son of a boxer, but in my head, he was just a preacher and an axeman, truly. And now I see why. All the training he did to develop into, you know, 6'3", 250-pound, unstoppable machine to fight, you know, Evander Holyfield, to, you know, to contend to fight Mike Tyson, to win the championship at 45. In order to do those things, he had to be conditioned as an axeman and live the solitary life of a preacher and do a lot of road work and pull a lot of vehicles to be strong enough to do those things. So that's all he did. I didn't know about all the fame and stuff until maybe 16.
Throughout George's childhood and early teenage years, he was almost completely insulated from his father's success and celebrity. His parents were committed to raising their kids to value the things they believed mattered most.
My mom is from an island called St. Lucia, a very small island. Her priorities were family and childhood safety and church 4 times a week. Church on Wednesday, Saturday evening, 7 o'clock. Sunday morning, 10 o'clock. And Sunday evening, prayer service at 7 p.m. That was life at home for me. Still is. We make every Sunday service every chance we get, but it's a little bit more difficult now that we're all older. But, you know, being the son of a preacher was just, this is what we do. That was my foundation of the world.
When George was 5 years old, his family moved from Humble to Kingwood, where he spent the majority of his childhood. But it wasn't the only place that felt like home to him.
My dad had the ranch in Marshall, Texas, and we were there anytime he just kind of felt the time to be out there. So all the time, I feel like. My mom always kept a home in St. Lucia. So really 3 or 4 times a year, at least we were in St. Lucia for a week at a time. So that really became a home to me. My dad has the church in just outside of Fifth Ward, East Aldine. So, you know, North Houston is my home in a really deep way. And the Fifth Ward and Acres Homes, just the north side of Houston, Texas, is very much my home. And my family is there. I mean, I've been all over the place, but I'm a Texan.
At age 11, George had the opportunity to leave Texas and enroll in the Fay School, a boarding school in Southborough, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, where he'd spend the next 5 years of his life.
I had an opportunity, really. My brother was in boarding school before me, so really my parents just discovered the world of boarding school. And my dad went to the Job Corps, so I think he kind of knew about growing up in dormitories and with counselors. And he put us into it. And that really changed everything. I became really an international student, but I was based in Boston. Kids from all over the world coming together to play football, basketball, study history, read the Canterbury Tales, pretend to read Great Gatsby. You know, all these little things that you do in high school, we did in a boarding school with dorm parents who were not our real parents, but took on that role and raised us accordingly. And that was 11 until 16, I came back home, so about 5 years.
George's experience in Boston was overwhelmingly positive. While it wasn't for everyone, he thoroughly enjoyed his time in boarding school. But as an athletic 16-year-old native Houstonian, the Northeast simply couldn't compete with his desire to experience firsthand one of the greatest traditions of his homeland, Texas high school football.
Oh man, Texas football was the dream. Under the Friday Night Lights, we played our playoff game in the Asher Dome, and we were underdogs, and we beat a top five state favorite. It was all the dream that you want in a high school football program. Teammates and late evening practices, and playing in the water, drenched pour, people getting knocked out, life lighted off the field. All the horror and excitement of high school football, I got to experience it.
But before he could experience all that, he had to pay his dues as the new kid in a small town, specifically in Huffman, Texas, about 20 minutes east of Kingwood.
Oh man, talk about culture shock. I mean, first day in Huffman, Texas, I come into school, and it was like that walk down the hallway when everybody knows. It's like everybody knew who my dad was, so they assumed I'm somebody too. And I remember going down the hallway, and I'm sure everybody feels like this in high school. Like everyone's looking at you. Maybe not. I don't know, but that's how I felt. And maybe a week in, I got challenged to like the Huffman street fight, after school street fights. I had to fight four guys that day. Nobody else had to do that, but.
Tell me this whole story, because this is.
Man, so it was just, it's a new small town, and I was just so underprepared for this high school environment, coming to a public high school. It was a small school, but because of that, anything you did, you had 350 students and about as half as many teachers looking at you at any given time. Anytime anybody did something, it was all eyes on you.
He didn't make any attempts to stand out, but nonetheless, people knew who he was, and they wanted to find out just what he was made of.
There's a guy named, I don't know what his name was, some random MMA kid at the school, and he hosted Friday fights after school in his front yard. His neighbor would oversee it, you know, they'd kick back a couple of beers in the cooler and watch the kids fight after school on Friday. I was asked to come and do this. I was challenged in high school at a new school, and I get a challenge to fight. I couldn't back down from that personally. I didn't tell my dad. I thought, look, I'll just do this real quick. It'll be a couple of rounds. You know, I'll really work my jab. I don't even think I knew. I definitely didn't. I hadn't practiced so much. I knew what the rules were, but I hadn't been in the gym. So I was not a boxer. But this girl took the top off her white Mustang Cobra and let me ride on the back through town to the front yard. Like, gave me a real entrance to fight this big man. They said he used to beat his shins with bamboo sticks so he couldn't feel kicks to the legs. So I was like, I hope it doesn't come to kicks because I'm not prepared for that. I was an all New England wrestler, played football, but I don't know anything about kicks and stuff. But there I was in the backyard surrounded by my entire school. So just in a little circle surrounding me. I'm a new kid in school, and I got to fight a kid. So we start the fight. He hit pretty hard, but to me it was all about, you know, just be tactical, hurt him, and then knock him down. I'm going to have to take some punches, but just hurt him, knock down. And I didn't knock him out, thank goodness, because I'm sure that would have been in the news. George Foreman's son pummels poor kid in backyard. But yeah, he was safe, and then after him, I felt pretty good. A couple more guys I wanted to try, so we sparred. There were some big ones, some small ones. I never got knocked out or knocked down. But once I got into football, all that stopped. All my fights were at practice where they should be.
Did you end up being friends with any of those guys?
Yeah, man. We see each other at reunions, and all the guys we fought in backyards with are, man, real estate agents now, and you know, work for UPS, and they're wonderful citizens. But we used to fight it out all the time, all kinds of fights. But it was, looking back, that was their initiation, and I took part in it. I took some, got some black eyes. Somewhere that video is still somewhere of me fighting four guys in a backyard in Huffman, Texas. But that was Texas to me. That was my welcome to East Texas. Welcome home from Massachusetts. You got to fight now. And I embraced it.
George paid his dues without complaining, and in doing so, established himself in Huffman and earned the respect of his peers.
I was instantly welcomed onto the football team. and put into a leadership position, which I embraced as a leader of my team. And by offseason, I was a captain.
His leadership extended well beyond the football field, though. He graduated high school in 2006 not only as the captain of the football team, but as the president of his graduating class as well. He had offers from a few colleges to play football and ultimately decided on University of Redlands in Southern California.
Honestly, I went to visit and it was the most beautiful place I'd ever seen in my life. Palm trees, sunny skies, you know, an hour away from Big Bear Mountain. You could drive to the beach and I could play football. There were some D1 transfers coming into Redlands because they could afford it academically. And it was Redlands was doing great at placing their athletes into professional workplaces. They were exemplary, you know, beyond perfect at that. So I was like, you know what, I can play football here. If I don't want to go pro, then at least I'm getting a good foundational education. I majored in English, world literature. I read Bram Stoker. I studied feminism. I learned about really the march and vocal movements of oppressed minority and what that really means. And I got an education and played a little football.
Growing up as one of 10 kids in an incredibly athletic family, George had more than his fair share of competitive drive, and it served him well on the football field.
I was a headhunter, and I'm not proud of it because I hurt my head in the process, but I'd play kickoff, I'd play punt. The coach would identify somebody he wanted, not knocked out, but just keep his person out of play. That was my job. Identify, target, I'll rough him up, keep him out of the play while the rest of the play goes on. In that process, I took some hits as well, but I also played running back.
Where did the aggression for that come from for you?
Man, good question. I just feel like I could take anybody one-on-one, and I always believe that. Any sport, I can take anybody one-on-one. Some guys are more difficult, and you have to be more strategic than aggressive, but I've always believed that. You give me anything, any task, just one task, I can accomplish anything. It's the multitasking that becomes problematic. You know, when you're a running back and you can get a play isolated to you versus one linebacker, have the coaches design it up, but you versus one linebacker, or you're running back, you versus just one safety, oh, that's heaven. Just cut, make the cuts, and then you get your one-on-one, and I can beat anybody one-on-one. You know, Jim Brown taught me to use my forearms, and there's a coach, Ronnie Harris. He fought Olympics with my dad, and he would preach to me about hand strength. So I would do things on my fingertips, on my hands. So if I could get my hands on your chest or in your face or neck, you could never bring me down. That's how I felt anyway. So that's how I played, try to get the one-on-one.
While his time at University of Redlands was in no way a waste, his days on the football team were cut short when, as a sophomore, he sustained a career-ending head injury.
I got a really bad concussion in the last game, in the playoff game. And it was unusual because, you know, I got hit at an angle coming from under my eye, which was rare, by a bigger guy. So he had a little leverage. And I remember getting up and spotting my coach and just walking to my coach. And the rest of the game, I was kind of just foggy. I wasn't off. I wasn't crisp. And I get back home and, you know, we go through the off season, the regular wind down. We watch film. The season's over, and I started getting these migraines unusually intense migraines, and it started crippling me during my study time. And I saw a doctor, he gave me some prescriptions, and it kind of made me foggy. I don't know what it was, but the doctor gave it to me, so I took it. And it made my day just kind of really foggy and drowsy, and I didn't like it. So I would take the medicine during the day so I could go to class and listen and study. I'd come back, do my writing, and just play a lot of Grand Theft Auto and go to sleep. That's really, after football, that was my life. A lot of literature, Grand Theft Auto, Papa John's, and bed. And that was life without football for me. And it got kind of depressing. I had the flashy car and the high rise in Grand Theft Auto, but I wasn't satisfied in life. Something was wrong. I had these headaches, and the pills were taking away the headache, but something was still off. I wasn't fulfilled. And I came home and I spoke to a headache specialist, and he told me, okay, here's what you're feeling and here's what it's from. This is post-migraine syndrome. And what you need to do is focus more on your diet and your meditation and your eating your caffeine input. He gave me a full rundown. He's like, and if you continue to play football and get more migraines, here's what's going to happen to you. You're going to have slurred speech. You're going to have memory loss. You're going to have, you know, he gave me the real breakdown of a long-term brain trauma. And that's what comes with football. He explained it to me. And I sat with him and I talked to my dad about it. And he was like, hey, man, just come home and let's make some money. And so I moved back to Texas, enrolled in the University of Houston, went to one orientation and saw how big that was. The next day, I transferred to Texas Southern University. I was like, nah, this is way too many people at U of H. And TSU became truly my alma mater. I became a journalist, a real journalist, like answering reports, deadlines, trying to get an article in the paper, published in the Houston Chronicle. They cut out part of my article. I was offended. You know what I mean? Like a real journalist experience. And football was gone after that. It took the trauma. It took the change. A lot of breakups in the meantime. You know, I was engaged and that didn't work out. And it was just going through that transitional time of trying to figure out who I am when I'm not a football player. That was not easy. All I knew was being on the field and with my teammates and coach telling me what to focus on and why it was important. There was three tiers: faith, family, and football. That's what life was about for me. And football was gone. So then what? Faith and family. So that's what I stuck to. And you know what? That's still my priority, my faith and my family. And good things come and go. I don't play football anymore. I love it. I hope to coach one day. But, you know, Texas and TSU meant family to me. That's where my family was. My dad got his honorary master's degree from Texas Southern University in communication. So I joined the communication school. You know, and I graduated with a degree in journalism from Texas Southern University only because I learned to be a student at Redlands.
What was it about Texas Southern specifically? Like, I mean, clearly it filled a void that football.
Yeah.
But what was it about that community that like just felt so at home?
I don't know why, because it's such a prestigious university with so many accomplishments, such a great, rich history of Texas pride and advancement of colored people. If that's your institution and that's what you're dedicated to, Texas Southern University has done it a million times over. But they, when you're on campus, we look at ourselves on campus as underdogs, and we work hard, and we work from a place of, at Texas Southern University, the student body works from a place of adversity. We accept that there's adversity for the student body going into the workplace. You're going to have to fight if you want to be successful. And that's what we teach our students. And that's the mentality that our students have when they come into the university. That's a unique environment to be in, to come from Redlands where everybody's pretty privileged. But TSU is different, man. I worked for a program through AmeriCAN. Jim Brown started a lot of Jim Brown stories. Jim Brown started AmeriCAN to help kids get back on track when they come from a disadvantaged place. So AmeriCAN partnered with Texas Southern University, and we started finding freshmen who were not enrolling second semester. Come to find out, only 11% of all incoming freshmen were re-enrolling the second semester. There's more coming back. Why? I don't know. So we started finding them and re-enrolling them every semester. And our numbers went up, and come to find out, the only reason they weren't reapplying is because they were getting jobs. They got into college, they got a job. They started substitute teaching. They started working for the Houston Police Department. They started working for the Houston Library System. They started working for Metro. They were satisfied. But we had to start bringing them back and say, finish your degree. You know, getting accepted into college is great, but their good degree is even better. And how do you, took me 10 years to finish college, but there are more than 10 students who I kept enrolled and who have degrees and are professionals because of the time I spent on campus. And I'm proud of that.
When he was 28 years old, George graduated from Texas Southern with a degree in journalism and communication theory. He'd spent much of his time at TSU studying world literature, speech communication, and gender studies, really examining the concepts of feminism and masculinity. Throughout his years as a student, he also found his place in the family business, working as a fight promoter. But we're not talking about backyard brawls in Huffman, Texas. These were real, legitimate, professional fights.
My dad used to talk about his dad J.D. Foreman. He worked for the railroad, and he would go out and by the side of the road, and guys would come up and say, all right, need three. They'd jump on the back of the truck and go. And I, you know, imagine what he had in his hands. He probably just had a lunch pail and like a shovel. If he had a shovel, maybe just a lunch bag. Anyway, if you have a toolkit for work, you wake up every day, you grab your toolkit and go to work, you can accomplish anything. You can make a day's wages. I looked down one day and I realized I had an entire boxing toolkit and I'm never going to put that toolkit down. It's just as you get older, it all makes sense. You know, you realize the guys that were rubbing you on the top of the head and patting you on the back and telling you you're going to, hey, look at that muscle. Hey, throw your jab right. All these guys that were just mentors, male mentors growing up in my life were all fighters or promoters or, you know, boxing managers. All the dudes I knew, I walked and dressed like a boxer. I didn't know why. Because all the older guys around me, that's how they dressed every day. That's what I knew. That's what all the boxers and boxing managers, promoters used to do, where they sit in restaurants, how they communicate with each other, where they eat on the sides of the road. These are all things I picked up from boxing that became part of my identity. So you look up and that's all I really know. Anytime I go anywhere, can I put a boxing ring in here? How many people can I pull in for a fight? I'll promote a fight anywhere I can put down the equipment. And that's my hard hat and lunch pail. That's my bread and butter. I learned that, so I'm a boxing promoter. If I have to fight, I will, but hopefully it never comes to that. I always say $12 million, I'll fight anybody, but that's my price, $12 million. Anything less is just not worth it. Hopefully I can always get somebody else to fight.
George's first fight promotion was in April of 2013 at the Frank Irwin Center in Austin, Texas. And since that time, he's helped promote well over 50 fights, including the May 2015 bout between Floyd Mayweather Jr. and Manny Pacquiao, which some boxing enthusiasts consider to be the biggest fight of all time. While boxing is certainly a part of his identity, his journey towards self-discovery continues. He's always on the lookout for new experiences that might help to answer the question, who is George Foreman IV? One of the ways he searches for those potentially identity-defining experiences is by putting his name out there for small TV and film parts. While he's not necessarily pursuing a career as an actor, he's willing to give anything a shot. And in 2017, as luck would have it, he got his chance with a Fox reality show called American Grit, hosted by wrestler John Cena.
One of the things I sent out, wasn't even paying much attention, was for American Grit. I get a call from a girl who went to school with my brother at GDA in Boston. The Governor's Academy, they call it now. It used to be Governor Dummer Academy. And she's like, hey, you went there too? I'm working on this show. I'll put your name in the interview slot. I didn't think anything of it. Did a couple interviews. I flew out to LA one day. And before I knew it, I had a one-way ticket to Georgia. And I was in a swampland with a bunch of random people and John Cena really running through mud and slop and being held tied up and dipped in ice cold water, all for a grand prize of $250,000. It was a competition show. They take a team of 16, divide them into groups of four, and you have your cadre leaders, which are military veterans. And your cadre leaders lead you and your team through elimination competition, all trying to be the grand. There can only be one winner. And I was part of that competition.
How far did you get?
I made it to the final six. I was so sure when I got there I was going to win the thing. Like I told everybody, thank you so much for coming out. It's my goal to be really kind to all of you. I'm happy to be here, but I'm here to send you all home. And that's how I greeted everyone for the first week. And by week four, I was like, yeah, man, I got this in the bag. And then I lost.
To his surprise, his downfall would come in a competition that he probably should have won pretty easily.
There is a really unique competition. So they submerged us in water with a flotation vest. And they give you a rope. They tie a rope, a knot at the bottom under your two hands. And you're suspended essentially with the rope above your head. And you're holding on for survival. And the catch is they strap on the weight, a box. And the box is half your body weight. You know, by this elimination, I'm the heaviest person in camp. Uh-oh, we're getting lean. We're leaning out. And it weighed down on my hands after a while. So about 45 minutes in, I felt a fish bite me and I kind of flinched. And when I flinched, I changed my hand grip. And I knew I'd messed up then. You know, whatever, you got to keep your grip. That's like, because the longer you sit, it becomes a knot. But I got distracted. And my hand slipped, and I was looking down, but I didn't let my coat, my cadre know that I'd messed up. And I changed my hands. He said, good job, good job. And I was like, you don't even know, man. I just blew it. But I held on for another 15 minutes or so in my head. And before I knew it, I was holding on as tight as I could, but the rope was just slipping through my hands. And it didn't make sense to me because I can, hey, this is, I'm me. I can hold it. I can hold my hands together. But with all my might, I'm holding my hands, and the rope is just coming out of my hands. And before we knew it, I was just suspended in the water, and it was over. It was over. So I, hey, walked up, rang out my bell, and man, the skin on my first three fingers on both sides had been, I mean, just torn. Didn't tell anybody. I was like, I don't want anybody saying I have excuses. I lost. It took me about 2 weeks to get the feeling back in these first three fingers. Pinky, ring finger, and the middle finger on my right hand. Just scorched. But I was proud of myself because there was proof. I gave it all I had. My hands gave out. Now, since then, I trained so hard on my hand strength. That'll never be the reason I give out again. Not my hands. Maybe something else. Maybe my wind. I need to get on the road and do some running. But my grip failed me. And that's the reason I lost.
Although he failed to take home the $250,000 prize, he gained something far more valuable in the experience.
I made friends who knew nothing about me. Some of them didn't even know who George Foreman was when they did find out my last name. So for the first time in my life, since, you know, as an adult, I made friends who just genuinely enjoyed me and cared about me, just regular old George. And that it made me love myself a little bit more, too. I feel like people like me now. I didn't know I had lost track of that.
What has the experience been for you of kind of figuring out your own identity in that?
You know, there's no way to know your own identity until it really hits you. And, you know, another little backstory. I remember I'll give you a real true story about identity. This is about a year ago. My wife had left me, and my son was at school. I dropped him off, and I got back home, and I'm not a good multitasker. And I plan poorly, and I'm a good journalist, but I'm not very financially literate because I always had somebody else to do it for me. That's the excuse. I'm also not a very good cook because I had someone else to do it for me. So I'm getting better. You know, mistakes teach you. But I'm sitting at home, and my hot water had gone. You know, I forgot to pay my gas bill. Stupid. And random, and I had to cut my hair because I had to travel. And I remember, I was shaving and cutting my hair, normal routine. And I just had a moment where you look at yourself in the mirror and all you see is what you are. And I said, you know what? I'm speaking to myself out loud in the mirror. I'm saying, I'm just a man. That's all. I'm just a man. But that's what I am. I'm a man. That's it. You're a man. I'm saying this to myself in the mirror out loud, fighting back tears because the person who usually helps keep everything together has left me, and I have no food at home because I didn't plan for groceries because I didn't do that. My wife did all that. And, you know, I know my son's at school. I think my mom will help me pick him up, so I'm okay. He's okay. What do you have? What are you? And I'm looking in the mirror. I'm a man, and that's all I am. Went in, I said, as a man, I have a tie, I have a jacket, I have an iron. I'm going to iron my clothes and dress up nice, and I'm going to go to work because I'm just a man going to work. I'm not a tall man. I'm not a foreman. I'm not a champion son. I'm not black. I'm not St. Lucian American. Today, I'm not even a Texan. I'm just a man. And then every day, I start my day with the same mentality. And what I put on from there is a choice every day. But I start out with just being a man. And I wake up in the morning, whenever I can get hot water, I shave my face, and I thank God for just being a man and alive. And it took me getting to about 30 to realize that. Now, if I can keep track of that, the other stuff doesn't matter. I learned that from my dad. I didn't realize I learned that from him. But that's what I learned. You know, he always told us the story of losing everything that he felt was important. How it impacted him losing his mother and father at 40 years old, 50 years old. He was open about those things. And he said, you don't have anything in this world. Everything that you see and touch in the world is the world's, and they can take that from you at any moment. But what you always have is your life and your identity, which is, for me, that's a man. I'm a man. Anything else is just what people call me. That's my foundation. I don't really care about anything else. What people call me, you know, what people associate me with, you know, what labels other people put on me, or what labels I have to check on an application. College graduate, check divorced, check married, single, whatever it is, check children, check, I'll check it. But other than that, I just try to wake up every day and just be a thankful man, and then see whatever comes with that. Good or bad, I'll just keep on moving forward.
So how are you passing that on to your son?
I got the name Big Wheel, and I've had to find out in life what that name means from other people around me. I call my son Wilson, ironically, because he's Big Wheel's son. He's George Foreman the 7th. His grandmother started calling him 7. That's a name he has. He's going to have to figure out what that means and if he wants to be called that. Names mean nothing. It's all about what you are. And I make him answer for what he does. And I ask him, look, what are you and what do we have to do today? You have to eat lunch and go to school. You know, like, that's all that matters. You can be whatever you want to be when you get there. But, you know, I just tell him what I am and let him decide what he's going to be.
The last thing I expected to hear George Foreman, the 4th of 7 so far, say to me is that names mean nothing. After all, his name has been such a huge part of his and his family's story. But I understand what he's saying and I agree with him. We're not defined by the names our parents gave us, or by the ways that others identify us. We're defined by our character, by the way we choose to live and interact with the rest of humanity from day to day. George, Big Wheel, does that with humility and kindness and strength and charity and simplicity and honesty. Over the course of this conversation and those that have followed since, I've come to respect him so much, not because of who his dad is, and not because of who I thought he might be, but because of the man he chooses to be day in and day out. George Foreman IV is just a good man. And now join me in welcoming back three of my favorite folks, Rennell, Megan, and Jenny, in their segment on the Houston restaurant scene, The Dish.
Hey guys, welcome back to The Dish. I'm Megan.
I'm Rennell.
I'm Jenny.
And I'm Luke. I'm so excited this time to get to have been with you guys to enjoy Republic Diner in the Heights. What did you guys think?
I loved it. Having heard you talked about it before and then knowing that it was closed, I looked at the menu, yes, the night before, but I really didn't know what I was going to get, and I loved it.
I knew you would. So this is a place that I used to go pretty regularly. I worked nearby, and they closed down what was supposed to be for a week during the summer of 2017. They closed down for a week, or it was supposed to be a week, and they wound up being closed for like 3 or 4 months, and it's like Chick-fil-A for most people. So for me, every Sunday, for some reason, I was just like craving Republic Diner, and they were always closed, so I never got to go there. So I was so excited to take you guys there. Let's talk real quick through what you guys had. Jenny, what did you have at Republic Diner?
I got one of their ramen dishes. So I ordered the Tokyo Truffle Shoyu.
Truffle Shuffle. I like that.
Truffle Shuffle. I really want. I keep wanting to say that, and yeah, it's not right, but it was delicious. It had chicken broth and I'm not sure what else in there, but it was...
There was definitely pork or something. There was some... What was the meat that there, was in there?
You know what? I think it was pork. Pork, and I'm not sure why it had a chicken broth, but it did. And then these little baby mushrooms that are really delicious. They're my favorite thing. I think Megan didn't even realize they were mushrooms.
I didn't even know they were a mushroom until Jenny shared that with me.
Until I shared that.
Yeah.
The more you know.
You had them in your dish also.
I had them in my dish too.
What did you have, Megan?
I had the Buddha bowl, and it was a vegan cream broth, which was a different take on the other ramens that have a clear broth. And it was just really like packed with veggies. And so it had corn and spinach and mushrooms, bamboo.
Yeah, it looked amazing.
And yeah, it was
wonderful.
I'm
just going to point out that you were the only person who didn't offer everyone a bite of your food.
I was just really enjoying it at the moment.
As a vegetarian, yours was the only one that I could have tried and I really wanted to, but you didn't offer, so I didn't ask. But Ranelle, what did you have?
I ordered the japchae, and to be honest, I ordered it because I was totally intrigued by the description, which was stir-fried glass noodles. And I was like, I want a glass noodle. It was so great. It had marinated beef in it and then a ton of veggies. And it was one of these bowls that just kept feeding you. It just kept refilling itself, it felt like.
Yeah, it looked really, really great. We also got the kimchi fries, which is one of, I have two kind of standard things that I get there. In fact, the one of the guys that works there, every time I walk in, he knows my order, which is really, really fun. I always get the kimchi fried rice with no beef because I'm vegetarian, but I also get the kimchi fries. Now, you guys got the fries with the beef. What did y'all think of the kimchi fries?
Oh, that was definitely one of our favorites. It was really good. The beef was really good with the fries.
It's got this aioli sauce on it. Oh, it was delicious. I think I could have just eaten that.
That's possibly why I couldn't finish all of my entree, because I kept eating the fries.
This is true. I don't think any of us finished once those fries came out.
We just kept eating them.
Well, and Megan pointed out when we were there that it would be a perfect happy hour to go because they have killer craft beer. I mean,
Absolutely.
They've got tons of really, really great beers on tap. And then just to get some of the kimchi fries, it's just so good. So, Ranelle, you and I had a chance afterwards to sit down with Ken, the owner who owns several restaurants in the Heights. Really great guy. And so we're going to cut to some audio from Ken, who answered some of our questions about the restaurant.
Republic actually was my first restaurant in the area, and it was called Dragon Bowl Asian Bistro. And we had this open kitchen, similar to what we have now, but it was a Pan-Asian menu. So we have some of those dishes that we've brought back with Republic. That's really my concept space. When I get bored, I reconcept it. And when I did that, I guess going on 2 years now, I wanted to do Korean food, to pay a little bit of homage to my heritage. And, you know, also there's nowhere in our area here to get any type of Korean food. Not saying that we're super authentic or traditional, but there's not really options right now unless you go to Koreatown or Chinatown. And I always wanted to do ramen a long, long time ago before we started, you know, getting our big ramen boom now. And that certainly helped me as a deciding factor to add ramen. So we shut down for a couple of months, added a handful of really cool ramen dishes, and we added a few more small dishes that I wanted to have on there. And of course, we still have the staples, the dulsat, the bibimbaps, we've got the Korean barbecue, the karbi, and bulgogi, and a few other Korean stylized dishes. That was really it. I just wanted to have a cool spot. And then when we shut down, I took the opportunity to kind of refresh the brand also, kind of update it and modernize it a little bit. So we did. I think you can see I had some fun with that and kept it really approachable and casual and not real stuffy at all. That was just kind of the basis behind that, the 2.0 version now of Republic.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for hosting The Dish and for everything that you do to make the city better. I love all of your restaurants, so thank you so much.
Huge compliment. You know, I told you before, I love the show. I love what you're doing. And it's truly an honor, man, to be on the show. So I really appreciate it, Luke. Thank you.
So that was our experience at Republic Diner. It's a great spot. It's at 11th and Shepherd in the Heights. We'd invite you guys, if you're into Japanese, Korean fusion food or really great beer, go check it out. Such a great spot.
And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at The Dish HOU.
Thank you guys so much.
Bye.
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 Friends, I can't tell you how great it feels to be back for a second season of The H. Huge thanks to George Foreman IV and to Ken Bridge for being a part of this episode. And as always, thanks also to you for loving this city and the people who make it great, and for supporting this show. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Also, be sure to follow us online at thehpodcast.com and on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at thehpodcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 2. This episode was produced and edited by me, Luke Brauner. Our artwork is by the amazing folks at Spindletop Design in the Heights. Check them out at spindletopdesign.com. Our theme music is by Robbie C., and other music featured in this episode is by Scott Benton, Cameron Pissera, and instrumental artist Roar. This and every episode of The H is brought to you in part by Pink Cilantro, a social-first digital agency focused on marketing, branding, and all kinds of other great stuff. Check them out at pinkcilantro.com. And now, here's a scene from episode 2 with Elise Bleckman.
And that was this really beautiful thing. It kind of brought me all the way around full circle. I was finally at a point where it's clicking again. It's all about people, and it's all about interacting with and celebrating with and grieving with or what have you that makes any of this stuff relevant.